This is The Takeaway. I'm John Huckenberry. Thanks so much for listening. The first debris, the first tangible pieces of the puzzle of Egypt Air Flight 804 from Paris to Cairo have begun to surface in the Mediterranean. The flight went down while cruising at 37,000 feet. Its abrupt failure and fall into the sea is consistent with foul play, and Egyptian authorities are being uncharacteristically candid about all this. But nothing has yet been confirmed. There's been no official claim of responsibility. ISIS has been skirmishing along the border and in the Sinai Desert with Egyptian troops for months now, and ISIS technically claims much of Egyptian territory as part of its so-called caliphate. Is this tragedy a sign of just how vulnerable Egypt's national airline and therefore its vital tourism industry is? The questions, of course, are too early for the grief-stricken families of the 66 dead from Flight 804. They are crucial to assessing the threats ahead, though. Miles O'Brien covers aviation as the science correspondent for the PBS NewsHour. He says in this case, the fact that Egypt Air is wholly owned by the Egyptian government makes it difficult to decipher its response to this tragedy.
When you have flag carriers, that is, national airlines owned by the government, investigated by another arm of the government, there is an inherent conflict of interest there. And that's something that in the United States we've managed to carve out an independent body, the National Transportation Safety Board, which owes no allegiances to the airlines themselves. And that's why we get honest and forthright accident reports. It's not the same in these countries, and it's something to watch.
And financially, the Egypt Air enterprise is bleeding from a terrible couple of years. It's the tourism industry is way down in Egypt, and Egypt Air seems to be taking the brunt of that. What are the numbers, if you could tell me?
Well, I don't know the numbers off the top, but it's a grim picture for Egypt Air. The terror problem has pretty much wiped out the tourism industry there. So passenger loads are down. And any time an airline is stressed financially, that's when the regulators really need to pay attention, because when you start cutting corners, it is a very slippery slope. Is it the maintenance they cut corners on? Is it the number of baggage handlers? Or is it, worst case scenario, are they cutting corners on security?
What are the issues here in this particular flight, where it originated and the fact that it took off from France? What are the points of vulnerability on the trajectory and flight plan of this Egypt Air flight?
Well, there are four other cities potentially in the mix besides Paris. That's where the plane stopped in the midst of its duty day. So it's a little bigger picture when you look at possible places that a device, for example, could have been placed on the aircraft, if we're assuming it occurred at the hand of one of the ramp workers or a caterer or something like that. But I think the important point we should all take away from this is whether it's Charles de Gaulle or an airport in Tunis or in Cairo, or for that matter, Atlanta-Hartsfield Airport, the back door of these airports, the part of the airport you don't see, is a huge, huge vulnerability. And we need to pay more attention to it. Maybe a little less effort on the front door, where we're going through and taking off our shoes and pouring out our water in what amounts to a little bit of security theater.
Let's talk about that for a moment. I mean, this is a week when the TSA delays in the U.S. airports have been particularly scandalous. Do you think there's a tension and overinvestment in that front end security and lack of observation of other parts of the whole supply chain?
Absolutely. I think we're putting way too much money on the front door and at the expense of the back door. I'm not saying we shouldn't have a secure way for passengers to be screened, but if it comes at the expense of monitoring what is happening on the ramp, we're making a big mistake. That's the Achilles heel. I mean, we've seen gun-running operations operating out of Atlanta-Hartsfield Airport. Drugs get on planes. If a determined worker wants to put a device on an aircraft, it's hard to say there is much in the way of stopping them. I'm not saying that people aren't watching on these ramps, but it's not like we have the level of security that the passengers endure at the front end.
Finally, the debris that they're finding, how is that going to be fit into the puzzle of what happened to this plane?
Well, initially, the debris can tell you a lot, depending on how it fails. Did it bend outward, and is there residue on it indicating an explosion? Or did it fail like bending a paperclip back and forth numerous times? That would indicate something as it fell aerodynamically. Or is it more kind of a blunt trauma kind of thing, impact on the water? That's important. Also, the location of the debris, when you reverse engineer the debris with the currents in the Mediterranean, will take you to the site of the wreckage, we hope. And that's the key, because that's where the black boxes are and that's where the real answers lie.
Miles O'Brien, science correspondent for the PBS NewsHour. Thanks so much, Miles.
You're welcome, John.
We turn now to Lise Doucette, chief international correspondent for the BBC. Welcome back, Lise.
Very good to be here with you and here with you in person.
Yes, indeed. Although, on an unfortunate occasion, to be sure, the plane reportedly fell from 37,000 feet to 15,000 feet. It's a way of clumsily suggesting that Egypt itself has fallen so far from what we were talking about just a few years ago, and appears to be in a very unsustainable situation. How would you assess what's going on in Egypt right now?
Egypt is in a tragic downward spiral, and yet there had been some little glimmers of hope recently, John. The Russians, who canceled all their flights, huge tourism earner for Egypt, that all stopped after the downing of a Russian charter plane over the Sinai last year. Egypt took a very long time to admit that that was an act of terrorism. But recently, Vladimir Putin indicated he may be willing to start resuming the Russian flights. So there were some more positive stories about Egypt. And then this happens.
There's been the suggestion that because it's a national airline, a flag carrier, it makes it more difficult to be candid about what's going on for Egypt Air. And although you get the sense that their response to this disaster indicates that they understand the seriousness of the situation, both in this incident and broadly, as you've said. Do you agree with that?
Yes, it's interesting. This is the third major airline incident that Egypt has had to deal with over the past year. But this time, even before there was much evidence, the aviation minister came quickly and said it is more likely to have been an act of terrorism than a technical fault. And people said, oh, before you even know. But they had enough to sort of try to seize the initiative. It is in stark contrast to how they dealt with the Russian airliner incident and were under much criticism.
And because this is a national airline, somewhere in that messaging, mixed or not, is the government, which appears to be also understanding that these are desperate times for Egypt.
Well, for the moment, it's desperate times for the families of the passengers, of the pilots. They will now want more answers about what exactly happened. If it was an act of terrorism, how was it carried out? So that's one thing. That's what the government has to deal with, first of all, its own people. Then the big question will be, where was the weak point? The last stop was Charles de Gaulle Airport. The French authorities say they swept the plane. Well, how closely did they sweep the plane? The Egyptians, of course, have said, well, excuse me, this wasn't us this time. France also has to answer some questions. So there may be more than one place to look for responsibility.
And also a moment for the region. I mean, there's no confirmation that this is a terrorist attack, and there's been no claim of responsibility. But it occurs to me to ask this question. I mean, ISIS claims the Egyptian territory as part of its caliphate, even though, you know, it's not in Egypt. Is Egypt a huge prize in this ISIS battle that we focus on in Syria and Iraq so much?
Well, all of the territory, as you say, is a huge prize because the caliphate, as they call it, has no borders. You know, the experts in these groups have found it rather mysterious, or at least they're questioning, why hasn't there been a claim of responsibility? There doesn't seem to have been what they call chatter among some of these jihadi or Islamist groups in the run-up to this, as there was before the downing of the Russian plane over Sinai last year. We still really don't know. We're in the realm of speculation. All we have is this affirmation by the Egyptians, by most Western intelligence officials, it was more likely to have been terrorism, but that still is not confirmed. And, you know, to the other part of your question, you know, Egypt, of course, is very much squeezed on all sides. I saw President Sisi last year, just before he was going to London, and he said, we warned the West about the rise of the so-called Islamic State in Syria. They didn't listen to us. He said, I'm going to London now to tell David Cameron, you've got to do something about Libya. Now, of course, the leaders in the regions have some questions to be asked of them as well. But we don't seem to be very good at, first of all, understanding what's happening and then putting the resources in place. in order to deal with it.
Finally, how much would you say the people of Egypt are suffering in this situation? And in civil libertarian terms, the Sisi government is not exactly a winner of any United Nations prizes. But how much does the West need the Sisi government to preserve stability in Egypt right now?
Think about Egypt. Just step back from the politics of this. Step back from, yes, the rising concern that this government now headed by a former military ruler, an elected president, Abdel Fattah al-Sisi, is now more authoritarian than President Hosni Mubarak, who was removed 5 years ago. And you'll remember, John, what a euphoric time that was in the region, no matter what side you were on, because it was a peaceful removal of an authoritarian regime. But fast forward, what has happened in Egypt over the past 5 years is absolutely, you know, dizzying, completely incomprehensible in the sense of where they have arrived 5 years on. And yes, think about the Egyptians. You see the photographs coming from Sharm el-Sheikh, other Egyptian resorts. This is the lifeblood of the Egyptian economy. Restaurants are closing, hotels are closing. There's so many people from at the top of the system to the bottom who depend on this industry. You have to think about them and how they are suffering. But yes, there are big questions about the crackdown on civil liberties. More than about 150 young people were given between 2 and 5 years sentence for going out and protesting against the fact that Egypt gave away two of its islands to the Saudi monarchy because, of course, the Saudis are writing the big checks for Egypt to help it through these economic problems. The United States, last year, President Obama, he resumed the military aid that had been suspended after the 2013 ousting of the elected Muslim Brotherhood government. And we are back to where we were when Condoleezza Rice, when she was the American Secretary of State, went to Cairo and said, we have been struggling to achieve either democracy or stability. And as a result of our choices, we achieved neither. And yet again, people are saying, why is President Obama, why are Western leaders, why are leaders in the region supporting President Sisi when he is an affront to democracy? Because they need President Sisi. They need him in the fight against the so-called Islamic State. John Kerry was just there recently to talk about Egypt again resuming its role in the Israeli-Palestinian talks, in playing a big role in the battle in Libya. So this is where we are yet again. But these same issues keep coming back to the region. And when they come back, they are even more terrifying, more complex, and more difficult to tackle than they were before.
Sobering issues to contemplate as part of the aftermath of this plane disaster, Egypt Air Flight 804. Lee Stussett, Chief International Correspondent for the BBC, thanks so much.
Thank you so much, John. Really good to be here.
I'm David Remnick, host of the New Yorker Radio Hour. There's nothing like finding a story you can really sink into that lets you tune out the noise and focus on what matters. In print or here on the podcast, The New Yorker brings you thoughtfulness and depth and even humor that you can't find anywhere else. So please join me every week for The New Yorker Radio Hour, wherever you listen to podcasts.